If you were charged in court in a police manner, wouldn't it help to know if the officer on the stand had been found unscrupulous in some manner during prior investigations? That was the point of a U.S. Supreme Court ruling 60 years ago, mandating a defense team be told when a witness has a history of untruthfulness. But the law was scarcely followed, not here or anywhere else. That changed in 2017 when the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office was revamped. In the past 5 years, it's dispatched 151 letters to police departments where challenged officers work. Welcome to the Sound of Ideas. I'm Rick Jackson. We'll start the hour talking to IdeaStream criminal justice reporter Matt Richmond about his reporting on letters sent by the county prosecutor's office and the role these letters have in helping ensure defendants are treated fairly in court. His work obtaining these never-before-released documents is the result of a public information request by IdeaStream Public Media in partnership with Columbia Journalism Investigations and NPR. Matt joins me to talk more about the impact and the importance of his findings. National and local news is first. It is the Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. Thank you for joining us. According to the U.S. Supreme Court, prosecutors have a constitutional duty to turn over any evidence in the state's possession that would be beneficial to the defense and to do it before a criminal trial. One kind of evidence that falls under this requirement is anything that raises doubts about the credibility of any police officer who's a witness or who played a significant role in the investigation. We'll start this hour by talking to IdeaStream criminal justice reporter Matt Richmond about his reporting on letters sent out by the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office, identifying officers with misconduct in their backgrounds and the role these letters, known as Brady letters, play in making sure people are treated fairly in the court system. Through a public records request from IdeaStream Public Media in partnership with the Columbia University School of Journalism and NPR, the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office has publicly released its Brady letters for the first time. Matt's here in Studio 4 to talk about these findings. Good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
Nice to have you back. Also joining us by telephone for the conversation, Michael Benza. He's a law professor at Case Western Reserve University. Michael, thank you for sharing your expertise with us today.
I'm happy to be here.
Folks, if you'd like to ask questions about this topic, the number to call is 866-578-0903. You may email us, that's soi@ideastream.org. You may also tweet us, we are at Sound of Ideas. Matt, start off with what made you want to look into this aspect of criminal trials, Brady letters, and why did you specifically focus on why they're used here in Cuyahoga, or how they're used here in Cuyahoga County?
Well, this is a question that's been out there for a while, is how is the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office recording this information? And, you know, in a lot of places, it's information that's been public for a long time. And so, you know, we wanted to figure out why it's not been made public in Cuyahoga County before. And so we started by asking, you know, kind of normally this is referred to as a Brady list, just a list of officers who have some sort of misconduct in their background that could raise questions about their credibility during, you know, in a trial. And so, you know, we asked for the Brady list. The prosecutor's office said, well, we don't have a Brady list. And so, of course, that, increased our interest in what exactly they have. And so then we found out that, you know, the system that they use where they send out the letters to police departments when they identify an officer with this information.
Same idea under a different name.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
Michael, this is a complicated topic to understand, especially for people with no legal backgrounds. Break down for me why, first off, a prosecutor's office is legally obligated to disclose information about officers before a criminal trial.
Well, the primary reason is that the government, law enforcement, and prosecutors are in the best position to gather most of the evidence in a criminal case. Defendants generally don't have lawyers or investigators until well after the charges are brought and the investigation is concluded. So the idea of a defendant's right to a fair trial requires the government to give over evidence that is either exculpatory, is impeachment, challenges the credibility of a witness, or mitigating, and that is that might decrease the severity of the crime or the sentence.
Without that, the state has an incredible, I guess, advantage over the defendant.
Absolutely. I mean, the reason this rule came into being was questions about innocent people being convicted when the government had the evidence that would prove their innocence and just didn't disclose it.
So the Brady letters help the defense team know whether a witness in the case, police officer in many cases, has a history of untruthfulness. Why would the prosecution put an officer on the stand who's known to be uncredible in the past unless they knew the defense didn't know?
Well, there's a number of tactical reasons. Actually, that's one of the biggest questions is why do they put this on? The real issue is, do they hide that officer and put another officer on to testify who doesn't have this baggage? But sometimes you're stuck with, this is the only officer that I have. And if the defense doesn't know, then the jury then doesn't know not to trust this witness's testimony.
Matt, Brady letters by any other name. What is Cuyahoga County's process for distribution?
So, you know, it starts every year, and this started under Prosecutor Michael Malley, and the first letter went out in 2018. They start every year by sending a letter to every police department in the county, mm-hmm. asking for any material on officers in the department that, you know, the prosecutor's office should know about and should consider disclosing. So then those responses come back, and a lot of times it's internal affairs reports, discipline, and it goes to, you know, a committee within the prosecutor's office that determines whether or not that information, you know, needs to be disclosed. And then, you know, if it does, a letter goes back out to the police departments saying, we've decided this officer, you know, based on this information, it has to be disclosed to a defense. And, you know, it's all public information. It's a lot of internal affairs reports that, you know, are technically public, but you wouldn't know about unless you knew to ask for them. It's a lot of information that's in officers' personnel files. The Cleveland Division of Police, they post disciplinary notices. Just recently, they changed from, you know, they have a list of disciplinary notices. They changed from identifying the officers on that list to just identifying patrol officer, sergeant. So, you know, they've become less transparent, but that is one place to keep track of what's going on with officers. And then, you know, there's information from court hearings and trials, and, you know, if there are things that happen in trials or, you know, before a trial that where a judge finds an officer to not be credible, that's technically public information. It happened in open court. But, you know, you have to know to look for it.
Right. You said all police departments. You don't just mean the communities. You mean like Cleveland State has a police force, the Cleveland Clinic has a police force. This is everybody.
Yes, every department.
866-578-0903 if you have a question for Michael or for Matt. Mike, talk more about the legal history of Brady letters. We talked about the idea that it goes back to 1963.
So the idea of Brady letters is actually very new. Part of the issue has become the litigation over, is this material in fact covered by the Brady decision? And most of the courts have said yes. If a police officer has a credibility problem, that is evidence that should be turned over to the defense. The response from most prosecutors, even today, is, I don't have any information. So part of this issue is the requirement that prosecutors actually do have to find this evidence because it is in the hands of law enforcement or in the hands of entities of the state. The knowledge is imputed to the prosecutors. So they no longer can say, well, I didn't know that this prosecutor or, you know, this officer has been found incredible or has this problem. So really what Brady lists are doing is helping prosecutors fulfill their constitutional duty.
Brady, named after the case in 1963. There's another case, Giglio versus the United States in 1972. Michael, how did that differ? How did that enhance the knowledge that we have now or the procedures we have now?
So it really built on the Brady decision, focusing on impeachment. Really, the idea in the early days was deals with confidential informants or jailhouse snitches were not being disclosed. And of course, juries should be known, you know, should know that a witness is receiving a benefit for their testimony. So Giglio refined the test under Brady, but didn't move it in some, you know, exponential way as a burden on the government.
Matt, you mentioned that the most letters went to the Cleveland Department. Of course, it's the largest in the county. That makes sense. But what have we learned by going through Cuyahoga County's letters?
So, yeah, from the first one that went out in 2018 to September of last year, there were 151 officers kind of added to this list. We'll call it a list. They don't call it a list, but we'll call it a list. And three of those officers were removed. Most of them came from Cleveland, like 103 of the officers.
Two-thirds.
Yeah. Yeah. And then second was East Cleveland Police with around 11, I believe. So it's there's a large gap. And, you know, the first one went to Cleveland Police Detective Rhonda Gray, who was demoted and very public discipline over failing to follow up on, you know, evidence in multiple homicide cases. And, you know, then writing reports that kind of tried to hide her lack of follow up. And so, you know, kind of in general, there's a lot of internal affairs reports that, and they don't offer any details. So it's not clear yet exactly what, you know, a lot of officers are on there for. There's a lot of arrests, a lot of DUIs, OVIs. And, you know, there are a few cases where it took years after the, and, you know, this is kind of an indication about how the prosecutor's office improve this process. It took years. You know,
it's deliberate.
Yeah, there was something that happened in one of them was 2012, another fewer 2014. And then in 2018, when this committee started, these letters started going out, you know, these officers were found and kind of this, the disclosure process for this misconduct started a few years later.
In a case like Detective Gray that you just mentioned, was somebody able to walk away from having committed a homicide because of her investigation failing, or did it all work out in the wash later?
Well, no, I mean, her demotion was because she kind of didn't do the investigation, didn't make the arrest that was kind of there to be made. So, you know, there was no one released, and I.
But the arrest did happen, just not with her.
I'm not sure in those individual cases what happened.
And you mentioned that a lot of the officers involved were just DUI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in a lot of cases, it'll be, you know, off-duty misconduct that they'll add to the list.
Michael, is it problematic in any way that the decision to add an officer to the list is made by a committee that's actually in the prosecutor's office, kind of puts them in charge of being in charge of themselves?
Well, and that's sort of the underlying flaw with all of the Brady issues, is that it is reliant entirely on a prosecutor making the decision about the type of information that will be disclosed. And so, yes, there is a problem. So, for example, a prosecutor may have evidence that a judge determined a particular officer was not believable, but the prosecutor's office has taken the position that either they could have challenged that issue and won that issue on an appeal, or that it's just one instance and this judge just got it wrong. And so that type of information doesn't necessarily end up on the list. The other problem is that a lot of these credibility issues don't turn on outside of the department conduct, but conduct within the department where agencies and prosecutors make their own decisions. I'm not working with this officer anymore. A couple of years ago, there was a very big case down in Richland County where slowly every department in Richland stopped working with a particular informant, including the federal government. And yet nobody disclosed that the reason this informant wasn't being used was because everybody determined he was lying. And so he continued to work with the departments that didn't reject him and receiving an untold number of false convictions because of his lying on the stand about what he knew.
Mm-hmm. 866-578-0903 if you have questions, or email your questions to soi@ideastream.org. Again, we're talking about how Brady lists play into the criminal justice system with a release here in Cuyahoga County that was discovered after Matt Richmond and NPR and Columbia University asked for public records requests to find out what this was involving here. Matt, this stuff's all been on the books since 1960. The information we have from 2018 and later, was nothing happening in those 50 years prior?
Well, sort of from what we've gathered, it was an informal system. When it was known in the office that an officer kind of was a problematic witness, you know, in some cases they might say, you know, keep him off the stand. There might be some disclosure where it's like, you know, this trial prosecutor knows about it, so he lets the defense know, or they make decisions based on it. But yeah, it was not, there was no kind of formal record keeping of it.
Yeah, don't want to necessarily call it haphazard, but it was very, very relaxed.
Yeah, and it was sort of case by case, and even more kind of contained internally.
I know you've been working on this for months, I guess would be a good way to put it. You spoke to a lot of officials in the prosecutor's office about the letters. What did they have to say about the process, and what did they tell you about how forthcoming they are? I mean, you just touched on it, but...
In some cases, they try to go beyond what's required. So, you know, the things like arrests of officers, stuff that shows up in the news, you know, they technically, based on kind of like the rules that cover what you can appeal, if it's publicly known and it was publicly known at the time of trial, whatever this officer's misconduct was, it's not the prosecutor's kind of duty to make a disclosure. So they add misconduct that they're not really required to. And like Professor Benzo was saying, in Cuyahoga County, they look at it through a lens of what might happen on appeal. And so, you know, there was one particular case from 2018, or one officer who was added in 2018, who had been found to have, you know, provided kind of non-credible testimony in federal court on several occasions, and the federal court sent a letter to his employer, Cuyahoga Metropolitan Housing Authority, saying, mm-hmm. you know, this officer is not, don't have him bring any cases to federal court anymore, and you know, 4 years later, that resulted in a letter from the prosecutor's office. And what
4 years?
Yeah, but I mean, that's part. You know, there were not letters being sent out between 2014 and 2018. He was the second or third officer to get a letter. But the, you know, the head of appeals at Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office, Kristen Sobieski, what she said is that in cases like that, you know, where there's multiple incidences of non-credible testimony, you know, we'll take a really close look at that officer, and you know, there's a good chance that they're going to get a letter. When it's a single incident, you know, we will look at that in the judge's decision, and we'll look at it through that lens of what can we appeal, what might we win from a different judge. Would a group of three judges at the appeals court here in Cuyahoga County, you know, disagree with a federal judge and say, actually, you know, this is credible testimony? So
when we look at the burst of letters in the past 5 years, 150, is that including some from pre-17, before O'Malley was there? You said it took 4 years in one case. So how many of these letters are new versus this is something we picked up?
Well, the letters are all new. The letters are all dated, you know, after, you know, April 2018 is the first
one.
But
some of the cases could have proceeded.
Yes, yeah, in some cases something came from a police department that maybe occurred, you know, one going back to 2012, mm-hmm. that, you know, came to the attention of the prosecutor's office. But most of them were, you know, they weren't systematically looking backwards and trying to cover everything that happened before 2018. Most of it is, you know, stuff that started then and moving forward.
They weren't concerned about covering what other prosecutors had done in other years.
Not systematically.
Not
finger
pointing. No. Okay. Michael, question. If the defense gets information from a Brady letter, does the jury have to be told where that info came from?
Yes, the jury, well, it would depend on how the defense wants to approach it. So at its core, what Brady requires is that the defense be given this information and decide how to use it during the trial. The admission of the actual letter would be the question of, well, how do we tell the jury about the misconduct of this officer for them to consider in the past? So it could be something that in and of itself would go, often it's during the cross-examination of the officer, you know, isn't it true you are on this list, you were found for this misconduct, those kinds of things.
Okay, thank you. You told Matt in his work that it's still an open legal question whether the prosecutors have to disclose. Why not?
Well, the issue becomes, how does the prosecutor get access to this information? Because once they have it, and once it's in the hands of the government, it's clear that this would be impeachment evidence. The dilemma that the law creates is that prosecutors have some degree of coverage to say, I don't have this information and I can't get it. And therefore, they don't have an obligation to turn it over. And that's really where the litigation is going, is do we impose an affirmative duty to go out and get this type of material?
Mm-hmm. Kind of interesting. Michael, we just got an email, unsigned actually, from someone who suggests that maybe the criminal justice system comes from an adversarial attitude toward the people being policed. Do you see that sometimes where, you know, there is a us versus them, and that may be why an officer suggests something that may not have happened? Is that something that's common?
Absolutely. We have an accusatory system where the government must bring the charges and must prove the charges. And that certainly creates the incentive on the part of the government's lawyers and the government's witnesses to make sure that they are proving their case. And that then can result in the gamesmanship of what information do you disclose and how do this witnesses testify in order to prove the government's case. And there's always this concern that witnesses will color their testimony in favor of whichever side they're testifying for.
Right. Matt, an officer who's been found untruthful in court comes up for, you know, becomes a trial witness in another case. It's got to be difficult, but has this happened? Do we have this on record?
That's a very good question. Something I'm trying to kind of look into for future reporting is some of the cases where this happened. I mean, it must happen. I guess it depends upon how you define untruthful versus making a mistake versus just kind of, you know, an honest disagreement about whether they did their job properly. So, you know, it's really hard to say how much that happens and how much those officers are being left off of this list.
Mm-hmm. I do want to touch on your future reporting in a minute. Got an email that came in from Jeffrey out in Moreland Hills, who was asking, Matt, and I think you touched on this in the very beginning. He writes, I assume misconduct by an officer can be the basis for firing. Does non-credible testimony ever rise to the level of official misconduct that results in dismissal?
That's another very good question. You know, I've seen a couple of cases where officers who ended up on this list were fired. Mm-hmm. I've seen a couple of cases where, you know, the union won a case to keep that officer on the job. It depends upon the specific details in each case and, you know, how well the union does if they go to arbitration. Mm-hmm.
Michael, can you answer Jeffrey's question similarly? Have you seen any cases where an officer maybe was fired as a direct result?
Only in those cases where it has risen to the level where you have multiple convictions now at issue or something that actually results in the arrest of the officer. We saw this recently in the city of East Cleveland, where the officers were arrested and charged with essentially shaking down people mm-hmm. that they stopped. None of that information, as far as I know, before their charges ever showed up in a Brady list because, of course, nobody was reporting, or at least the police department was not keeping reports that people were complaining about this. So it does often have to rise to a pretty high level before an officer would be subject to termination. And often what happens is you see people like this simply quit this department and move to a different department. And I must say, this is not just something that happens within police officers. We have seen the same type of issues come up in crime labs where technicians don't do reports but write the reports in favor of the prosecution because they know that's what they want. And they eventually will be found out, and then they move to another jurisdiction and get a job in a different place. So it's a much bigger issue than just police officers.
I'm sure a lot of people's minds go right back to Tamir Rice and the fact that, you know, that officer had been elsewhere and maybe shouldn't have been in Cleveland in the first place.
Yeah, it's a really good, but there are several officers on this list who are, you know, doing basic background checks. I found it had moved to other departments. Mm-hmm. And that is a big issue. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's important to kind of make this information public.
Yeah. Michael, let me switch the question a little bit from has an officer been fired for this to should an officer be fired mm-hmm. from this?
Well, you would certainly think so. You know, their job is to collect evidence and to provide the testimony of what they found and investigated. And you would think that being found to have given false testimony would be grounds for termination. Again, it's just a matter of, is the department willing to do that? Can they win the issue at arbitration? And can they prove it? There's always a fine line between giving color commentary on your information and lying about information.
With the passage, Matt, of Issue 24 last year, we now have civilian oversight of the Cleveland Police Department. Is that something that might change in how officers are added to the list or how it's reported back to the prosecutor?
It'll be very interesting. You know, written into Section 115 of the Charter is Bradio and Giglio, and the Community Police Commission. Part of their job duties will be to maintain a Brady list of their own of Cleveland police officers. You know, with everything that that Community Police Commission is going to do, it's a big open question how that'll work, how they're going to get that information, how they'll decide, you know, who should be disclosed. But, you know, I think in the coming years, a lot of this work will become more public, and we'll see a lot more of it, I would expect. Mm-hmm.
Professor, Matt's work has been largely in with O'Malley's office and here in Cuyahoga County, but half our audience is outside the county. Do you know if this is happening elsewhere in the state or in the region?
There are a number of counties that maintain a formal process of these Brady lists. Lorain County, I believe, does. I'm not sure that in the Lake and Geauga they do. I believe Summit does. But that also may have changed as these start to get more publicity. Prosecutors' offices are under more and more pressure, both legally and politically, to do these types of things.
Okay. Matt, I promise I'd let you talk about what's coming up. This is an ongoing story. As we said, you're working with Columbia Journalism and with NPR, and you can't give away all that you're doing, but what should we look for in the weeks to come?
Yeah, I mean, we're taking a look at this issue of Brady and about some of the problems that have come up in, you know, sort of older prosecutions, some of the wrongful convictions that have occurred in Cuyahoga County and how these happen.
It is fascinating work. Just so much goes on, and so many people now have so much more interest in our police departments, not just Cleveland, but all the police departments, because of what's been unveiled. Certainly, we saw the tragedy in Memphis last week. You know that people are going to be attuned to this. So thank you for the reporting, but I think that they'll be watching closely now as you continue to work.
Yeah, thanks, Rick.
Okay, thank you. I want to thank not just Matt, but Case Western Reserve University Law Professor Michael Benza. Thank you for being here as well this morning.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
And you can check out more of Matt's reporting, including the story that ran on this topic this morning during Morning Edition, by going to ideastream.org. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll talk to the new Chief Diversity Officer at the Greater Cleveland Film Commission about the aim to bring more equity and inclusion in the film industry. You're listening to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Rick Jackson. We will be right back. You're with The Sound of Ideas from Ideastream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. For the rest of the hour, we're going to highlight efforts to bring greater equity and inclusion to the arts in Northeast Ohio. We'll hear about two newly created positions addressing diversity, first at the Greater Cleveland Film Commission, later at the Cleveland Orchestra. Both were announced this month. So joining me first in studio, Lowell Perry Jr., who joined the Greater Cleveland Film Commission as their Chief Diversity Officer and Vice President of Corporate and Community Engagement just a couple of weeks ago. So thanks for doing this.
Yeah, boy, I tell you what, it's great to be back in Cleveland.
Mm-hmm. It's been a whirlwind for you, though, I guess, getting your feet back on the ground?
Yeah, it has. It has. And, you know, reconnecting with old friends, making new ones. And
yeah, you're moving here for this job, but you're no stranger. You were here many years before. Right?
Yes, yes, right. I was. I was with the Sisters of Charity Foundation mm-hmm. and was the director of the Central Promise.
Central Promise, right. Yeah. I was reading that. Mm-hmm. Folks, if you'd like to join the conversation here, talk to Lowell. You'd like to interact about discussions of making Cleveland's film film industry more equitable. Toll-free number 866-578-0903, locally 216-578-0903. You can tweet us at Sound of Ideas. You can email us, soi@ideastream.org. We're monitoring all of those. So as we said, you just returned. Tell me about your time here before when you were with Central Promise.
Well, when I was with Central Promise, actually, I was enticed back here to Cleveland at that point because our youngest son, Trenton, was playing basketball up at Eastern Michigan. And a former colleague from my Big Brothers, Big Sisters of America days had reached out. She was on the search committee, Margaret Mitchell, and asked if I would be interested. And when I found out it was only about 2 hours and 10 minutes from the field house in Ypsilanti, Michigan, where actually I was born, my wife and I jumped at the opportunity to get here and had a chance to work real closely, not only with the folks in the central neighborhood, but many of the strategic partners that we'll be engaged with now with the Film Commission, you know, like CSU, like Tri-C and others, the city, the county, and also really looking forward to that. And I've told people here, you know, the snow notwithstanding, you know, I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, right. So I'm used to
this is not home, but it's home.
Yeah. In many respects, it is. My mom is still up there. Our oldest son is living in Detroit. But the best summers that that we've had, my wife and I and our almost 36 years of marriage, have been here in Cleveland. And different trip this time, though, Rick. Yeah, we were Westsiders our first tour here, lived out near Crocker Park. This time we're on the east side, and there's just so much to do here. I'm just thrilled as can be.
I was talking to some folks who were new to town, maybe 6 months or so yesterday, and they were just amazed that there's still things that they're discovering every day because you're right, there is so much here. Yeah. So let's talk about your title. I read that big, long title, essentially Chief Diversity Officer. Yeah. There's been an increase of that over the past few years. We were looking at LinkedIn and they were saying that between 2015 and 2020, it's doubled worldwide, the people with titles like yours or just like yours. You've held this title before, though, with Big Brothers Big Sisters.
Correct.
And, you know, it makes me say there's much more of an emphasis of companies to pay attention.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's real important too. And it's not just hiring a chief diversity officer to check a box and to say that, okay, we've done what we're going to do in that area. It's really a signal that an organization is ready to make an even stronger commitment to being inclusive in their policies, in their processes and procedures. And inclusion for me has always been the operative word, because if you have an inclusive corporate culture, then you're going to, by definition, become more diverse. And I think the Film Commission is very much committed to this. When I met originally with the president, Bill Garvey, and other members of the team, Seema Jaiswal and others, it was apparent that they were all on board with doing this. And that's all about creating, as I said, a culture. And that requires board involvement, that requires us as an organization to be able to walk the talk by doing those kinds of things internally, as well as the things that we'll be doing more of in the community as far as creating more opportunities for so-called minority vendors to participate in film and media production in this area by making sure that, you know, in our workforce development piece where we're creating a visible pathway for people who are interested in a career in film production, to make sure that many people that look like you and I and other so-called underserved communities have a real opportunity to be exposed to it. I create kind of the visual, if you will, of a tent with a wide open door that's saying, come on in, and not just a little sliver that somebody has to try to slip through.
Yeah, you made the point about how companies can come at it from two different ways. There's internal, yeah, we need to do this, or there's external pressure that makes you do it. Obviously, you chose the former, but now that you're there, what's your primary goal? I mean, how do you open that tent flap?
Okay. Well, you know, my goal is really to work on and expand on the things that have been happening here prior.
Yeah, you're not starting from zero.
No, not starting from zero. It's just more formalized now for the Film Commission. And so I am in the process of continuing to do some due diligence here to see some of the good things we're doing, to see some areas of opportunity that we can expand upon or add to the mix in terms of our outreach to underserved vendors. To see where we can create more opportunity for people that live here that want to go into the film industry. I happen to, one of my hobbies, I have been a Screen Actors Guild after actor. I've been in a number of films and television and
go
commercials.
Go ahead, name drop, Denzel Washington.
Boy, I tell you what, I had a chance to work in a film with Denzel Washington, with Kate Beckinsale. We lived in Nashville, Tennessee for a dozen years. So I was actually was in an episode of the TV show Nashville, Drop Dead Diva, just to name a few. So it's been a blast for me. It's something that's been helpful just in my presentation
Nashville,
skills.
Nashville, the Connie Britton show.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, in fact, I've played Connie Britton's lawyer in her divorce in the episode that I was in.
Okay. That was you. Okay. If you want to talk to Lloyd, 866-578-0903. You know, we talk about the film industry wrestling with some of these issues, whether it's Cleveland, Nashville, Los Angeles, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And we're not that many years removed from the Oscars So White campaign, the hashtag right. that was everywhere. Right. Directors of color have spoken out about trouble getting films produced. We right. are a major film player when it comes to some of the big budget films. What's it right. been like for directors of color and really industry people of color everywhere mm-hmm. in Cleveland?
You know, that's one of the things I'm still trying to get my head around. I know that there are a number who have participated in some of the things that we're doing. I know that there's still plenty of work to be done. I've been setting up meetings with people that are in film production direction and all to kind of see what they feel. I mean, my MO when I was with Big Brothers Big Sisters, for instance, and that chief diversity officer turn was on a national level. And one of the things that was important was to go out to the customer, if you will, and find out what they wanted. You know, we did the same thing in my last stop in Yuma, Arizona, as the executive director of the Yuma Crossing National Heritage Area, in a city that was over 60% Hispanic, and there was no direct engagement with that community. So rather than coming up with some bright idea and saying, this is what we're going to do for you, we decided that it was better to say, okay, how can we figure out what we can do with you? How can we best engage? And so those are some of the conversations that I want to have in the local base in terms of what can we do to be more effective, more efficient, to make sure that people are prepared to understand, kind of the rules of engagement with some of these production companies, and especially, you know, the oft-overlooked crew that participate in these many productions. And that's the primary area of focus for the Film Commission is to get people geared to be able to show up on a set, know how things work, know how to make sure that you not only know what you're doing, but you look like you know what you're doing, even early on in your career.
Yeah, I wanted to go there because we're not just talking about directors, producers, and actors. You're talking about truck drivers and caterers and grips and the people who are pulling the cables and running the rigging.
Yeah, and look, that's where the main opportunities are, and for somebody to make a fairly lucrative living, even here in Cleveland, you know, with the number of productions and the size of productions, it's in a sense, creating a small business opportunity for some people because, you know, you're pretty much a freelancer in working with some of the local production.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, like for instance, the film White Noise that was just here, and a couple of Golden Globe nominations. I know Adam Driver was nominated in that film,
right.
but I want to say that was over 101 million-dollar direct spend from that production here in Northeast Ohio. 256 some odd vendors participated in that, and you're spot on. You know, whether it's truck drivers, whether it's you
one
know, lighting,
driver, and 256 others.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're just there's a uniqueness there, and you know, a couple of the. My teammates on the film commission have direct experience in that. You know, Bill Garvey, the president, mm-hmm. Came from New York and has been on a number of things like The Sopranos and was on the Avengers movie that was done here. And our production coordinator, Mike Wendt, same thing. You know, he worked in locations just like Bill was a location manager and all. And now I bring the talent side of the table, you know, being an actor and understanding how you need to act around there and make sure that you're not getting in the way and that it is a team effort. And in many respects, when you think about it, this is another form of manufacturing here. In Northeast Ohio. The product just happens to be a film or a television show. You know, it's not unlike somebody coming in and investing a bunch of money and you know, building a new warehouse, a new hotel, a new office building, and that kind of thing. You're putting people to work with viable jobs. You're creating a professional opportunity for people of all stripes, if you will. And in this case, in film production, you don't need a college degree in order to go down that road. And, you know, where we're focused on primarily is as a production assistant, and there are many opportunities across the hiring phase, if you will, for a production with a APA.
Okay, let me squeeze in this one caller. Danny's been waiting for a while from the west side of Cleveland. Danny, jump on in here. Welcome to the Sound of Ideas.
Hey, thank you. You know, I'm just curious if there's any way to couple your title now with trying to get the legislation to get more money here, maybe because we're doing this, what we're doing, filmmakers may want to come here. I liked what you said about all the different jobs. I ran a skid steer on one of the movies, made great money. It was just a thrill. I'm thinking maybe with that opportunity corridor with the vast expanse, maybe there's a place for the warehouse to keep stuff. So when people come here, we have everything we need to do a movie.
A lot of ideas there, Danny. What do you think?
Yeah,
thank you.
No, Danny, I think you raise a very important point here. And we are working very closely on improving the Ohio Motion Picture Tax Credit opportunity here that will and is the number one driver for productions to come here. We currently, I think there is a $40 million cap, and we are looking at the Georgia model, which is now the gold standard of the industry that would make it uncapped, would allow it to for people to be able to apply on a rolling basis. There is legislation that just dropped in the Senate recently. It's Senate Bill 341. And if that bill passes, and I understand that there's a good chance, that could really boost our opportunities here in Northeast Ohio. All of the neighboring states have gone down that road.
We need to, too.
We need to as well. Yeah. I mean, here's an example of the economic.
I'm running short on time, but I promise we will have you back once been here longer than 3 weeks. Great conversation. Lowell is the Chief Diversity Officer, Vice President of Corporate and Community Engagement for the Greater Cleveland Film Commission. Your title's too long, but thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I've got to figure some kind of cool nickname for
that. Okay, you got it. Final break right here. We'll learn about another Chief Diversity Officer coming up. Stay with us. It is the Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Rick Jackson. The Cincinnati Symphony was the first major orchestra to hire a diversity, equity, inclusion officer back in 21. They were followed by ensembles in Atlanta, Minneapolis, now Cleveland. Joanna Brown is the first director of DEI at the Cleveland Orchestra. Lifelong Clevelander, graduate of Glenville High and Cleveland State, even a former IdeaStream employee earlier in her career. She was most recently in a similar leadership position at the Greater Cleveland Partnership. IdeaStream's Kabir Bhatia spoke with Brown about her plans for this historic new role with the orchestra. This is pre-recorded, so no calls, but send your thoughts to SOI at IdeaStream.org.
I remember going to the orchestra when I was in school. I will say that in the fifth and sixth grade, I played the violin, and that my family was very happy when I stopped. So that was not a talent of mine, but I did retain a love for a wide range of music. And so I've always appreciated the nuance and the expertise and the skill that it takes for someone to be a classically trained musician.
And I have to think Greater Cleveland Partnership and Cleveland Orchestra are very different organizations. What drew you to this role?
What drew me to this role was the opportunity, one, to work with an organization who has global reach. And so that was very important. The intricacies of the orchestra, this organization is very complex and nuanced. And it was a new opportunity for me to really deepen my skill set in diversity, equity, and inclusion, and a love of a global organization that's based here in Cleveland.
Looking ahead in your first year, what are some goals you have?
My first goal is to learn the building. The building itself is just a wonderful resource. Understanding the history, understanding where the orchestra comes from will definitely help to see where it expands to. Understanding who comes to hear the orchestra. And we have a wide range of audiences. So we have audiences for Severance Hall. We have audiences for Blossom. And even within those two venues, there are still different audiences within them for the different types of programming that we have. You know, if we have film, some people come to film, but they don't come to concerts. So really understanding that those intricacies and nuances of the audience will also help to make recommendations and to craft a strategy around how to engage, how to expand, and how to diversify audience participation. Currently, we have a employee resource group called Ready. That is a group that I will be working with, and they focus in on education and training, looking at systems and processes. So as we're looking at that, how can we continue to strengthen that group, strengthen the activities of that group internally?
You mentioned the READY group, that's for employees.
So READY stands for Racial Equity, Access, Diversity, and Inclusion. This group is made up of members of the board. It's made up of members of the executive leadership team. It's made up of staff members as well. And we also have musicians who are members of the READY group. They have come together to move forward a goal of the board for us to continue to unify the power of music with people of all races, identities, and abilities. In order to do that, we need to have some intentionality around that. And the board and the organization felt that the READY group was a first step toward that intentionality. Out of that, one of the things that they have done have been some education and training internally around anti-racism and implicit bias education and training sessions. And that includes for staff, musicians, volunteers, and trustees. There is an organizational assessment that is provided by Greater Cleveland Partnership every year. And the orchestra has participated in looking at that internal assessment. It's an internal survey of the organization in terms of where they are in regards to their DE&I efforts, and it provides some internal benchmarking that the organization can use to move forward with their goals. So those are some of the things that we've done. And I think that additional programming that they currently have internally, that those are the things that we want to continue to look at. What else can we continue to do to further deepen our efforts and our intentionality around being an inclusive organization for everyone who comes.
Now, the music which the orchestra plays, especially the basic repertoire, which hasn't been so diverse for the past few centuries, I know you won't be choosing the selections yourself, but is that going to be more diverse in the future, maybe reflect the audience more closely?
The orchestra has already been very intentional about trying to diversify the repertoire, the composers, the number of solo artists. And so as the orchestra is being intentional about diversifying the repertoire, you will see us continuing to do that more and more. You know, we have our composer in residence with Allison Loggins Hall. You have commissioned piece by Wynton Marsalis as an example. And there are many others. We have solo artists, even our opera that we have. You definitely begin to see people that are very diverse from not only from a racial background, but also from different ethnicities and countries. And so it's the intentionality is there. We're continuing to build on it. You know, I expect that the music director and the artistic team will continue to amplify that as they move forward.
Musicians, I know, have gone out into the community, a lot of times into schools. There's, of course, many programs where students come into Severance Hall and experience things. What are your thoughts on expanding those, changing those? Any thoughts on that?
Actually, the Dr. Martin Luther King program that we had was a showcase for that. There is a program called Crescendo, and that expands from third grade all the way through 12th grade. There's also a mentoring component that is a part of it. And those students were from a wide range of schools. They were from Cleveland Public Schools as well as other area schools. And so it was great to see the age. It was great to see the diversity of, you know, you had males and females. You just had a wide range of people that were on the stage that showed that music is for everyone. And I really loved their energy. I love their enthusiasm. And I think that that program is something that continues to expand. And I know we have our neighborhood partnering programs. And so there are a lot of different programs that are going on from an educational perspective. And I think we are continuing to look at how we can expand those, how we can deepen our relationships with the various neighborhoods and partner organizations that we currently work with.
That's Joanna Brown, the Cleveland Orchestra's first Director of Diversity and Inclusion with IdeaStream's Kabir Bhatia. More about the orchestra's community outreach efforts and Crescendo is at arts.ideastream.org. Tomorrow on The Sound of Ideas, a proposed youth drop-in center in Ohio City generating a lot of debate. I'm Rick Jackson. I'll talk to you then.